Splendid. Good to see you. Thank you so much for coming here and being here so early in Greenbelt. So I've called this image and imagination, divine and human creativity. And I'm thinking about or trying to answer questions like, what does it mean to say that we're made in the image of a creator God? How might our own imagination help us to deepen the mystery of God's creative and loving word in us and working through us? So I'm going to start with an account of imagination, and particularly the role of imagination in poetry, the poet's imagination bodying things forth. Perhaps the classic account, the great account, if you're going to find out what this poetry thing is and how it works and how a work of imagination might serve or help us, then you might as well go straight to the top and ask Shakespeare, you know, would you let us in for a moment into the sort of workshop and smithy of your writing? And happily for us, he does just that for us, playfully, in that most playful of all the plays, I think, Midsummer Night's Dream. He puts into the mouth of a hostile witness perhaps the greatest account of what poetry is, greatest brief account of what poetry it is that's ever been written in English. He puts, the hostile witness is Duke Theseus, who has a wonderful speech towards the end of A Midsummer Night's Dream, where he says, well, you don't want to believe this poetry. These poets are all just making it up. And except he says it in beautiful poetry, in iambic pentameter. And he also says, you don't want to trust these antique fables and these fairy toys and all that. And he is an antique fable. That's what he is. He's Duke Theseus. You know, he's just married an Amazon. Or is about to marry an Amazon. So Shakespeare rather plays with him. And although in the course of the speech he's trying to deny the truth of poetry, he actually gives an account, a truthful account of how it works. Right at the beginning of Act 5, all the action has taken place. You remember A Midsummer Night's Dream has a strange double setting. It's set in Athens, in the beautiful, daylit, rational court, you know, the Parthenon, the beautiful, geometric, reasonable stuff. Except it just so happens that just behind the Parthenon and up just beyond Athens is a magical twilight English woodland with Puck and Oberon and Titania and Peas Blossom and Cobweb and Bottom the Weaver. And you remember that at the beginning of the play, there's four lovers who are completely mismatched. You know, it's the classic, I love her, but she doesn't love me because she loves him, and I hate him because he loves her, all that stuff. And they all get whisked off into the woods. And in a series of moonlight, dreamlike transfigurations after meeting Puck, they sort of pretty much in the dream state try out every possible permutation of who loves who, and they come back sorted out and ready to get married. And all that's happened, as it were, from the point of view of Theseus and Hippolyta, sort of off stage. They haven't seen that. So at the beginning of Act 5, they come on, and they've obviously been told the story of what happened. Now, they didn't see it, but we did. We know that within the play it's true. But Theseus is doubting. So here's how it goes. Hippolyta says, she's the Amazon queen, 'tis strange, my Theseus, that these lovers speak of. And then bluff, practical, no-nonsense, self-made man, Theseus says, ha, more strange than true. I never may believe these antique fables, nor these fairy toys. Lovers and madmen have such seething brains, such shaping fantasies, that apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends. The lunatic, the lover and the poet, are imagination all compact. One sees more devils than vast hell can hold, that's the madman. The lover, all is frantic, sees Helen's beauty in a brow of Egypt. The poet's eye, in fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. And as imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Such tricks hath strong imagination that if it would but apprehends some joy. It comprehends some bringer of that joy. Extraordinary passage. So on the surface of it, he's saying you don't want to believe this stuff. But the more you look at his definition of how poetry works, the more powerful and compelling it becomes. Let's just listen to that again. The poet's eye, in fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. So just pause that for a minute. It's about seeing, but it's about seeing more than just what's in your middle field of vision. It's certainly glances to earth, and it's got to deal with the visible, the palpable, the touchable, the physical stuff of this world, the things we see and hear every day. But it's also got some sense of a heavenly reach. Indeed, it almost seems to be wanting to make a bridge between those two things, heaven and earth, from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. How does it do that? Surely we think of imagination as being a kind of airy-fairy, ipsy-wispsy kind of, you know, half ethereal thing that's not, you know, to do with the palpable and the touchable. But what does Theseus say? He says the poet's eye glances from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. And here it is. This is just a wonderful moment in Shakespeare. As imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes. Just incredible to put those words, imagination bodies. Now, as this is a talk about poetry, anyone who's ever had to grind through a GCSE or an A-level will realize that you don't get the full points in the essay unless at some point somewhere you use the word juxtaposition. You have to put that in. This is the moment. Okay, so what is great is the juxtaposition, i.e. the putting next to each other, of the words imagination and bodies. Because if we did a quick sort of, you know, word association game and all those little clouds and writing things, you know, very rapidly on whiteboards that I can't do, if we did that and I said imagination, we'd get all these words which were very ethereal and unembodied and detached. And if I had the other group saying, let's talk about bodies, we get, particularly if we're a bit further on in Greenbelt, you know, we get lots of words like sweat and, you know, odour and, you know, clammy and, you know, hot and cold and bothered. And, you know, it would be all very, very physical, wouldn't it? Because that's what bodies are. And we would never have thought of putting those two things together. Indeed, if we're going to talk about heaven and earth, another way of thinking about heaven and earth is perhaps visible, the earth, and invisible, apprehendable. We wouldn't, you know, we'd put them in separate categories. We might go imagination, heaven, earth, bodies. But Shakespeare doesn't do that. He juxtaposes the two words and he makes imagination body, do the bodying. He puts the two words together and bodies in this sentence, as imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown. Bodies isn't even like, it's not like a noun, like a plural noun. As Shakespeare says, elsewhere, this too solid flesh. Some scholars think it's too sullied flesh. I'm personally going with solid, you know, but he puts them together. Imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown. Imagination, for a poet's imagination to work, for it to do the job it's going to do, for it to bridge heaven and earth, the invisible and the visible, for it to move us from those things we scarcely can, we get a glimmer of. It's like peripheral vision. It's an apprehension to bring that into some kind of seeable, touchable, imaginable, physically. We need imagination. Imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown. So bodies is not a noun, these lumpen things. It's a verb, and it's a verb in the present continuous. Imagination is continually bodying, giving a body to something. As imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes, another very physical thing, and gives to airy nothing, and this is beautiful, a local habitation and a name. by a work of imagination, we can put a name to something that actually might be very real, but we'd not been quite be able to know. A shape, a name, a home, an address, a door opening into which this thing can be found, or better still, a body that can be touched. And of course, Shakespeare is having great fun giving this account of poetry, because there was a chap with a real body standing there saying those words. And Shakespeare's art, the whole marvellous dreamlike quality of Midsummer Night's Dream, is quite literally bodied forth. Because his particular kind of poetry involves not just moving words and ink on paper, but moving bodies in space where other bodies are gathered. It's an embodied art, if ever there was one. So it's a great account of how imagination is actually making visible the invisible and somehow reaching between heaven and earth. And in fact, if you notice that great central passage, the core of which is the juxtaposition of those two words, imagination and bodies, you know, the power of that, two words that you would never have thought of belonging together, actually turning out to have a transference and a need of each other. I don't know, did you ever do that experiment in science when you were kids, where they gave you a bar magnet? And you could do cool stuff, like you could put iron filings on a paper, and then you could stick the bar magnet underneath, and then miraculously the iron filings formed a pattern because there was a hidden field of force. I think words are like that. Words, you know, you can look up at the meaning of a word in a dictionary, but that's only one thing in cold type. I mean, semantics is the study or science of meaning. And I think words have a kind of semantic field, a kind of hidden flow of line. And quite how that works, quite how it partly depends on the way the words are put together. So do you remember the other thing with bar magnets? Where if you had them one way around, they went like that. And that, okay, a magnet, that's what it does. But if you flipped one of them around and you put the two poles together that didn't want to be together, you could feel this kind of quivering force between them. Do you remember doing that? And you suddenly become aware this isn't just a piece of cold iron. There's a kind of pulse of power going on. And indeed, it's out of that pulse of power, spinning magnets, that in the end we get electricity. So I think words are like that. And one of the things that, so he's put those two words, imagination and bodies, and they're kind of doing that. There's a kind of energy in it. It's a wonderful thing. So there's a very good account of how works of art work. And do you notice he prefaces this beautiful account with two lines, one on either side of the central description, both of which have two words in the same line. And those words are apprehend and comprehend. If it would but apprehend some joy, it comprehends some bring of that joy at the end. And imagination apprehends more than cool reason ever comprehends. Now that's really interesting. So the prehend bit of apprehend and comprehend is to do with getting hold of something or taking hold of it, right? Like, do you remember being told about how certain animals had a prehensile tail and they could pick things up with it? And I remember as a child thinking that would be really useful to have a prehensile tail. Apprehend, you're reaching out and you can just about touch it, but you can't get your whole mind around it. Yeah? Comprehend is when you've got the thing completely surrounded. So it's inside your comprehension. Yeah? You understand it. Now, there seems to be, as it were, a spectrum here being presented between apprehend and comprehend. And maybe we can think of that as a bit like the spectrum between the heavenly and the earthly. That we apprehend certain things, but we can't get hold of them until somebody bodies them forth and brings them into the realm of comprehension. But equally, if a thing can be completely comprehended, then it's less than we are. We've got ourselves around it. That's why we're told in the John's Gospel that the light shines in the darkness and the darkness has never comprehended it. It's never completely, there's always more to the light than the darkness ever gets. You know? And there's always a kind of plus factor. So there are certain mysteries we can't quite comprehend. So what happens is when we comprehend something earthly, either we can just comprehend it and that's it, there's nothing else. But sometimes we have a feeling that glimmering through the thing we've already comprehended is an apprehension. Seamus Heaney has a great opening line of a poem, which is, it's about an old forge, and the opening line is, all I know is a door into the dark. You know, everything I know is leading me to something else. Now, let's think about this definition of poetry as imagination bodying forth and building Ferrari nothing, our local habitation and a name, by glancing from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. Just as a way of thinking about works of art, works of imagination, acts of imagination, it's quite a helpful model. If you think about it, the bodying forth of imagination is trying to make a pathway or a bridge or a connection or a ladder between heaven and earth, between the apprehended and invisible and the comprehended and visible. Yeah? And generously, Shakespeare says that the poet or the artist can start at either end. You can start with glancing at earth and seeing something and then gradually open it up and realize it can be more. Or you can start with the apprehended and find one after another different ways of embodying it. And different artists work in that way. I think, for example, T.S. Eliot seems to me to be a poet who starts at the invisible, intellectual, apprehendable, you know, sort of visionary side of things, and then keeps trying to find different ways of bodying that forth in the poetry. And he actually says it in the poems. He says, that was a way of putting it, not a very, you know, words slip and slide, decay with imprecision. I'll have another go, you know? There's only the trying. So Eliot's got this thing. He's starting at the heavenly, and he's trying to find it, okay? Now, another poet, great poet of our time, who you could see as starting at the earthly end, would be Seamus Heaney. So Seamus Heaney, perhaps the most famous poem about the digging, where he's sitting there, got nothing to say, sitting in the sort, and then he looks down and he sees his dad digging, and suddenly he loves it all. You know, he, you know, the squelch and slap of potato cold cuts through the peat, and the feeling their cool hand, loving, you know, sound in our feel in our hands as he spread the potatoes out. You know, digging, going down for the good turf. Wonderful, wonderful physical account of all different kinds of digging. And you think, oh, great, you know, thank you. I'm really getting a sense of what it is to dig potatoes or cut peat in Ireland. This is really good. Thanks. And then, of course, it's just this wonderful turn at the end. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it. And you go back through the whole poem and you realize that everything he's said, so literally and viscerally and visibly and bodily true, all in what he called the rough, porous language of touch, everything he said about digging turns out to be about writing, about poetry, about going down for the good stuff. Yeah? So suddenly, this poem, which is so earthy, has become a local habitation and a name for all sorts of things that you'd half known about writing and about why certain art moved you, and suddenly it's all there in this poem, yeah? So you can see, I've used examples of two great poets who succeed in bodying forth the invisible and the apprehended, and who make that bridge. And that's wonderful when that happens. You can also use this model as a way of thinking about works of art or acts of imagination that don't quite work. So there is a certain kind of poetry and perhaps some kinds of art where you feel there probably was some heavenly glimpse, some apprehension of an almost airy nothing, something inexpressible. But actually, you know, you keep trying to read, and it just doesn't give you enough. The poem or the work of art doesn't successfully body forth the thing. Or if it's built a habitation, then actually all the windows are blank and all the doors are locked, you know, and you waste, you know, 2 hours with a difficult teacher trying to pick the lock of the poem, you know, and you're still on the outside. So something's gone wrong there. But you can equally find the poem or the work of art which starts at the earthly end and, you know, says something nice about a flower pot. And then you go, yeah. And then, and that's it. You know, that's your flower pot. Well done. You know, you've got it. There's nothing more. You know, whereas you can, as soon as you get to anything, a work of art, which actually turns out not to be just a one-off, but a local habitation with open doors and windows at the back into which the unembodied and the scarcely apprehended comes freshly with each reading to meet you in that house of the poem. You know when that happens, and you know it with paintings, and you know it supremely with pieces of music, that there's a little bit more going on. I always feel the poem for me that really does that, and it's not a religious poem in any way, is except in a very, very subtle way, is Keats's Ode to a Nightingale, which was the poem that made me want to be a poet, which starts on the earthly end, you know, very unpromisingly. You remember that starts, I read this poem as a moody adolescent on the wall of Keats's house when I was 17, having been dragged there by one of these improving aunts that thinks that, you know, that the first thing you want to do on the school half term is to be taken and given a lecture about Keats, whoever he was, you know. So I was dragged along there, and then I realised suddenly who he was. Oh, my goodness. And they had the Ode to Nightingale up on the wall right in the room where you could look through the French windows, and there was the tree the nightingale sang in. So optimal poetry reading conditions. But I was in a bad mood, you know. So I was reading this poem on the wall, and it goes, "My heart aches, and a drowsy numbness pains my sense, as though of hemlock I had drunk, or emptied some dull opiate to the drains 1 minute past, and lethe words had sunk." And I was going, oh, ache, drain, sunk, lethe. I'm with you. I know exactly what he's like. Bloody hell, you know. I was really gay, you know. And so, you know, you're with him. And then he hears the nightingale. And suddenly you're moved and you're lifted out. You know, thou light-winged dryad of the trees, in some melodious plot of beech and green and shadows numberless, singest of summer in a full-throated... You think, oh, goodness, I didn't know. And then you remember in that poem, magically, and for no kind of logical reason, he suddenly gives you, right near the back of the poem, the image of magic casements opening on perilous seas in fairy lands forlorn. And it brings you to the brink. You think, there's more, there's more. And then he goes, forlorn. The very word is like a bell that tolls me back from thee to my soul self. And but you've been given a sense that somewhere in the back of this poem is a door or a window that leads into heaven. And I keep knocking at the back of the poem to find it. Now that's creating a local habitation and a name. So, thank you, Shakespeare, for telling us a bit about the way poetry works. Now, I must be a bearer of very little brain, because I've known and loved that Shakespeare passage since I had the chance as that same moody adolescent who was kind of cheesed off because of basically, you know, he was kind of lonely and was stuck in an all-boys school. And then, miraculously, the very next year, the girls' school moved next to ours, and we were allowed to do plays together. And the first play we did was A Midsummer Night's Dream, and I got to be Puck, which was awesome. So I knew this speech very well by then, and I've lived with it all this time. And I gradually got some of the things I've said to you now. And it was only when I sat down some years ago now to write a book about how poetry might help us in understanding and deepening our faith, how poetry and theology might talk to each other, a book called Faith, Hope and Poetry, I was haunted by this Shakespeare passage, and I was going like, heaven to earth, earth to heaven, bodies, habitation, name. What does this remind me of, this thing that you might be going round and round and round in sort of heavenly stuff, but then you need somewhere? And it's like, dong, you know. Why didn't I see that this is a beautiful riff on the prologue to John's Gospel? You begin in John's Gospel, remember, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the same was with God in the beginning. It's great, you know, I'm sure it's fantastic theoretical theology, but I can't see it. There's nothing. And you're kind of going through all of that, and then suddenly you hear these words, and the Word was made flesh, bodied forth, and dwelt among us, tabernacled with us, tented with us. We beheld his glory, glory as... And of course Shakespeare, everybody likes to go, Shakespeare, the authorized version. But of course Shakespeare wouldn't have had the authorized version, Midsummer Night's Dream, because that was in the 1590s and it didn't come out till 1611. But he had a bit of Latin, he had the Vulgate, and he probably had a Jewy Bible and a Geneva Bible. Anyway, so if you look at the Latin that he would certainly have heard quoted, the first question to Jesus by the disciples, Master, where are you dwelling? Jesus says, come and see, glance. But in Latin it's Magister ubi habitat. Where is your habitation? Come and see. So I began to see that this account of human poetic creativity is in some way, I think, gently riffing on the great act of divine bodying forth, the Word himself, love given a body and dwelling among us. And maybe that deep bodying forth, which is, of course, Jesus. I mean, the other thing that's going on is we're trying to link heaven and earth, earth and heaven. He is the creator of the heavens and the earth, of all things visible and invisible. Yeah? Do you remember in the same John's Gospel, the same chapter one, when Nathanael, who's always, at this point, we think seeing the earthly things, and, you know, his mate says, oh, can we think we found the Messiah? And he says, who is it? Jesus of Nazareth. And Nathanael goes like, Nazareth? Can anything good come out of Nazareth? You know, it's obviously Nazareth was on the cover of whatever the local copy of Crap Towns was, you know. I always love that. I think it's Bedford or Luton that's on the cover of it now. But anyway, you know, so you have to think that. Yeah. So, and then you remember what happens, of course. Come and see. The very words that Jesus had said. Come and see. And he comes. And even as he sees Jesus, Jesus sees him. And he says, I saw you sitting under the fig tree. And he says, oh, you're the Messiah. And it's a moment of, you know, complete enlightenment from a glance. Jesus says, Nathanael says, how can you know all that, you know? And Jesus says, do you say this because I said I saw you under the fig tree? And then he says, you will see greater things. You will see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending. And you can imagine Nathanael saying, I know this one, because Jesus has called him a true Israelite. So the angels of God, he says, Israel, Jacob, Israel, this is all about Jacob's ladder. You will see the angels of God ascending and descending on Jacob's ladder. That's what he thinks Jesus is going to say. But, you know, Jesus carries on, doesn't he? You will see the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. It's a kind of hidden I am saying in John's Gospel. I am Jacob's ladder. I am the link between heaven and earth, between the invisible and the visible, between the apprehended and the comprehended. I put all the mysteries that you could have ever glimpsed in philosophy before you in flesh and blood, the flesh and blood of your Christian neighbor and the bread and wine of this Last Supper. That's bodying forth. Now, that is a kind of embodied poetry that every poet would love to achieve, but we can't manage quite ourselves. But we've got the pattern. We've got the basic idea, because, of course, God is the maker, and poiein in Greek means to make. So a poet is a maker. He is the maker, the poet of heaven and earth. So maybe there is a parallel, and maybe Shakespeare is deliberately riffing on the parallel between our own particular human making, our desire in our own small way, in our acts of imagination, to body forth the form of things unknown, to make a shape or a habitation into which we can invite the not quite comprehended to dwell, so that we can walk through a door of comprehension and glance at the end through a window of apprehension and get a glimpse of something we might otherwise never have seen. So we can be like that moment in George Herbert's poetry where he says, a man that looks on glass, on it may stay his eye, or if he pleaseth through it pass, and then the heavens espy. So if we think there's a link, then maybe this will be a helpful way of helping us to think about what it is when we say in Genesis that when God said, let us make man, he said, let us make him in our image and after our likeness. So this becomes one of the great themes of theology, the Imago Dei, as it's called, that how is it and in what way are we made in the image of God, in the image and likeness of God? Now, there are lots of ways of answering that, and thinking about it in terms of God as Trinity, and thinking about the way we only become ourselves in relation to other, and we each give each other the gift of personhood, that's certainly there. There's something about free will. There's something about love. But I'd like just to chip in amidst these mysteries. The great thing about dealing with the deepest mysteries of the faith is, I remember a Franciscan friar once said this to me. He looked me beadily in the eye, and he said, a mystery is something about which the last word can never be said. And then he added, that's not a challenge, Malcolm. But I've been trying. Yeah, but into that mystery, I'd like to at least suggest that one of the ways of thinking about the image of God in each of us and all of us is actually in that word, which also contains the word image, which is imagination. The power to imagine, the desire within the imagination to body forth, the way in which the imagined work or world can become more than itself, can become, as it were, a window or a doorway into something more, can be capable, even though it's a finite thing, of generously generating for generations of readers a kind of moreness, a kind of overplusness, a sort of extra possibility, which we all recognize in certain works of art. So maybe that's part of where that resonance is. And I'm not the first person who thought that, obviously. And I discovered, I'm a great fan, as some of you may know, of the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and also very much aware of him now as a great theologian and thinker, as well as a great literary critic. And I sometimes feel in all my own personal explorations of the deep mysteries of my faith and trying to, you know, when I'm climbing some inaccessible mountain height of thought and thinking, golly, I must be the first person who got here. And I get to a little ledge and there's a big graffiti that says, STC was here, you know. And I keep finding that Coleridge got there first, you know. So I have to say, Coleridge, who loved this play and wrote very well about Shakespeare, not just drawing it from this, but from other things and from his own reflections, thought very deeply about God in his role as creator, as a kind of divine poet, and about our own works of imagination, our own acts of imagination, as being in some sense kin to or images of the work of God. Coleridge was the person who said that the job of poetry was, to borrow a phrase from Blake that Coleridge didn't use, but it was to cleanse the doors of perception. What he said, what Coleridge said, is that he and Wordsworth were hoping to awaken the mind's attention from its dullness and lethargy, to restore to us a vision of the wonder and freshness of everything around us, which we had covered with what Coleridge called a film of familiarity. And you had to peel that back. So that's one of the things that Coleridge thought poetry should do. So it wasn't about creating some imaginary private world that wasn't real, but rather using the imagination as an instrument to see more fully the wonders of the actual world around us. In other words, imagination for him was a means of perception and a truth-bearing faculty. It was Coleridge who grasp the idea that you might think about the cosmos itself as a kind of divine work of art, a divine work of poetry. He wrote the famous poem Frost at Midnight about he's being a sort of new man and sitting up with the nappy over his lap and the baby in the and his wife's asleep, and you know he's supposed to be looking after the baby, but the baby's temporarily asleep, so he's doing poetry instead. And he has this great bit where he imagines how he'd like his own child to be brought up in contrast with it, and he says, "But thou, my child, shall wander like a breeze by lakes and sandy shores beneath the crags of ancient mountains," and he describes a beautiful natural scene, and then he says this, "So shalt thou," this is the babe growing up, "so shalt thou see and hear the lovely shapes and sounds intelligible of that eternal language which thy God utters, who doth teach himself in all, and all things in himself, great universal teacher, he shall mould thy spirit, and by giving, make it ask." Wonderful idea. But of course, the more he felt that the cosmos might be a sort of, as it were, a poem, the more he began to realize that in his own age, the age of enlightenment and the beginning of the scientific, you know, the closely materialistic scientific way of things, what we might call a reductive material science, he realized there's a terrible danger that what was going to happen is, if you take a poem, which, you know, is printed in a book, you could spend a long time analyzing the chemical composition of the paper. And then you could finally get onto the ink and you could be fascinated by the contrast between ink and paper. And then you could do a brilliant statistical analysis of the frequency of certain shapes and recognize there's a pattern, but you're not sure what it means. And then you could do geometric. You could accumulate 50 volumes of unassailable scientific fact without ever grasping that it was a poem. And when you finally did grasp that it was a poem and responded to it, not just with your analytical mind, but with your answering imagination, and saw, because you could make them in your mind, the images that the poet had made, you would have an entirely beautiful new apprehension of the poem. Now, not one, it wouldn't contradict in any way or threaten or contradict or be in conflict with any of the actual facts you'd ascertained about the chemical composition of the paper or the frequency of the letters or any of that stuff. But you'd now know what that stuff was for. Do you see? You'd move, if you like, from one way of knowing to another. Both ways of knowing would be important. You've got to see the paper and see the ink. But so Coleridge began to realize that just to perceive the world right, to get something of what God was doing, we needed to bring imagination to the table. And he became aware that the more you think about the way we actually do perceive, the more it is active and shaping. There's such a mass of stuff coming in at us in terms of little bits of information. It's only because we have a predisposition to see the human face and to look for that shape and find meaning in it that we distinguish faces. It's the first thing we do as a child, is try and distinguish our mother's face. We've heard a voice, we want to see a face. Our mind is actively shaping and excluding irrelevant bits and focusing on it. And the philosopher Immanuel Kant had begun to see how the shape of the mind affects the shape of what we're doing. So Coleridge was very much trying to see how that worked. And eventually, in a book he published in 1817, he came up with a very famous definition of imagination, which links directly to this question of what it means to ask about us being made in the image of God. And it particularly links, in an unspoken way, to the other bit of John's Gospel, the preface to John's Gospel, that I think is so important, which we say, in him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness has never comprehended it. But he is the light that lightens everyone that comes into the world. Everyone. So that is saying that the same word, who is also light, who speaks the cosmos and all of us into being, is also a light inside each one of us, a responding word. There's a kind of either side, you know, both out and beyond and within. And Coleridge put it like this. He said, the imagination, then, I consider either as primary or secondary. The primary imagination I hold to be the living power and prime agent of all human perception. Just pause there for a minute. That's pretty amazing. The living power and prime agent of all human perception. You don't have to wait till you're writing deathless prose or a great immortal play or, you know, a note to the milkman, to decide that you're going to be imaginative and creative. Just by looking at the world and thinking about it and shaping it and caring about the shape of a tree and realizing when you see a tree with roots and branches that you too are part of a tree with roots and branches, and that you have a family tree and that you have deep roots in one place and that your branches extend out, and then you realize your thought has branches. You not only see the cosmos, you think with it. You talk about a lightened day or a lightened load. You use metaphors of gravity and light and darkness. You see the world as drenched with meaning. You're reaching out to it, just as when you hear a poem, you're bringing something of who you are to it. So it's the living power and prime agent of all human perception. But that's not the end of the sentence. The imagination, then, I hold to be the living power and prime agent of all human perception. And as a repetition, this is great, a repetition in the finite mind of the eternal act of creation in the infinite I am. A repetition in the finite mind of the eternal act of creation in the infinite I am. It's a beautiful way. He loves to talk about God as the infinite I am, because I am, of course, is the name that God gave to Moses at the burning bush, when Moses said, who shall I say sent me? Tell the children of Israel, I am has sent you. So your perceiving the world is a repetition in your mind of the very act of making the world that God is doing eternally. Now, the word eternal does not fall lightly from the lips of Samuel Taylor Coleridge, because he was a real philosopher and he had Greek. So he doesn't use eternal as shorthand for sort of going on forever and ever in a series of instants of time. He realizes that God is beyond time. to quote Augustine, God didn't make the universe in time, but with time. When we say in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, that beginning can't be a bit of time beginning, a chronological beginning, like beginning, middle and end, because there'd have to be time already, wouldn't there? So it must be another sense of arche, beginning, principio it is in Latin, some in the source. And of course, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Christ says, I am the Alpha and the Omega. Augustine says, the real beginning in which God creates the heavens and earth, before there's ever a beginning and a middle and end of time, is Christ. The font in the Word, he creates everything. And the eternal Word is always there. So then he makes time, and things happen in time. But his act of creation is eternal. And one of the things that means is that we're no further away from it now than, as it were, the moment it began. Because God is present to every moment, and God is eternally acting that. So there's a lovely, I don't know if you know the South American writer Jorge Luis Borges, wonderful blind poet and parable writer. He's got a great bit in one of his short writings where he says, do you want to see what has never been seen, and hear what has never been heard, and touch what has never been touched? Open your eyes, open your ears, the reach out your hand, the cosmos is about to be created. It's just being created now. We have that in our hymn, don't we? Praise for them springing fresh from the Word. So what Coleridge is saying is that at every moment of our existence, God is breathing us and speaking the poem of the cosmos, including us in it, into being. And we're just like somebody who reads a poem. I mean, when I read you that, I quoted that Seamus Heaney poem about the squelch and slap of soggy peat and the curt cuts of an edge. Those words are not soggy peat and a curt cut, so they're just sounds, aren't they? But you all felt the squelch and slap of soggy peat, didn't you? And it was your soggy peat, not Seamus Heaney's. He just gave you a few signals, and you brought your rich imagination and made it happen, didn't you? The same with Shakespeare. I mean, you've got to be you already are a poet if you love poetry. Because what the poet does is just batting the ball into your court. You know, you bring your full active imagination to make it into the poem. If the poem is printed on a piece of paper and read by a computer, it's not a poem. It requires a rich human imagination made in the image of God to respond to it. So what Coleridge is saying is that that's how it is if we would only wake up to just the miracle, you know, what the poet Philip Larkin called the million-petaled flower of being here. Every time you look at the human countenance divine, God's made the poem of that person's face, and you're responding to it. And it needs as much of your imagination in responding to it and seeing it for what it really is as it took God's image today. It's a repetition in the finite mind of the eternal act of creation in the infinite I am. That's the primary imagination. Coleridge goes on to say that then we get to make our own little worlds. And he says, I made a few. I hope that when you read my rhyme of the ancient mariner, I procured for these shadows of imagination that willing suspension of disbelief which constitutes poetic faith. Let me make something that also bodies forth a truth for you. So that way of seeing things is not that the image of God in us is something that was stamped in us long ago in Adam and Eve and then has been covered over by the fall and broken and eradicated. It may have been covered over. It needs to be refreshed. It certainly needs a bit of cleansing off. But it's not like some dead image. It's a living power, which is the light lightening everyone that comes into the world. And of course, finally, that lost image comes into absolutely clear focus, perfect focus, and is bodied forth in Jesus Christ. And the more we look at Jesus Christ, the more we see what that is. So William Blake, contemporary with Coleridge, they actually met, which is amazing, and somebody who arranged for their meeting wrote a little letter about it, said it was wonderful. He said it was like being on, you know, momentary two planetary angels conversing on our sphere for a minute, and you're going, yeah, but what did they say? You know, and he doesn't tell you. But we know that around that time, Blake was writing the long poem, Jerusalem, which says, O Jesus, O divine imagination, whom I have crucified, I turn my back on thee into the wastes of the moral law. And that Blake also saw, he said, I know of no Christianity other than the liberty of both body and soul to exercise the divine arts of imagination. He saw imagination as central to recovering the Imago Dei in us. So I've spent some time trying, won't do it now, but trying to reconstruct what that conversation might have been by extracts from both of their works and putting that together. And I hope to bring that out sometime as a sort of dialogue, imaginary dialogue about imagination between Blake and Coleridge. But these guys were writing at a time when we were just about to abandon that way of seeing things. And we were going to just look at the chemical composition of the paper and the shapes of the ink and forget the divine poem. But we, at least, you know, certainly the Christian churches, but I think the other faiths, are keepers of the memory that all of this is a poem and that we're in it and that we need the imagination to read it. And that's why I'm particularly thrilled that that this whole event is called Acts of Imagination. Now, I just wanted to, I'm already coming to the end of my time, but I want to just throw in two other pieces of writing that might help the discussion. My praise of imagination and my praise with Coleridge of imagination as a way of apprehending what is real is not meant in any way to be a denigration of good science and good rational philosophy and reason. I think reason and imagination are like two eyes. We need both of them. Our problem is that we've separated them in a terrible and false way in our contemporary Western culture, that we've said reason deals entirely with the objective. And with the objective we've decided is the only real thing. And imagination deals only with the subjective, and that's some private whimsy little thing here. We've made this awful split between object and subject. Though if you think about it, as soon as you say I am, you are both object and subject, aren't you? The I that says I is the subject, but what is the object? You. Every consciousness is always fully both object and subject, so you can't say they're different or split them up. They're each giving access to important truth. So it's about bringing them together. And I thought I'd just share with you a cry from the heart, a desperate plea from somebody who felt that split so deeply. Somebody who wrote, "The two hemispheres of my mind were in the sharpest contrast. On the one side, a many-islanded sea of poetry. On the other, a list of facts that seemed to me grim and meaningless, a glib and shallow rationalism. Nearly all, everything I loved, I believed to be unreal and imaginary. Everything I believed to be true, I felt grim and meaningless." Who wrote that? C.S. Lewis, describing how he felt before his conversion to Christianity as an atheist Oxford philosophy don in the 1920s. He wrote that account later in the 50s, but we now have a poem written by C.S. Lewis at that time, in which he does an amazing thing. He imagines his soul, and I think this could be all of us, as like the ancient city of Athens, and it's got two goddesses. It's got Athena, who represents wisdom and rationality and the beautiful order of the Parthenon. But he's also got Demeter, this warm, mothering, beautiful, creative, dark spirit beneath him, and he needs to get them together. This is what Lewis wrote. I wonder if it would ring any bells with you. So, it's an astonishing poem. We don't know exactly when he wrote it, but probably about 1927, 1928. "Set on the soul's Acropolis..." It's funny that it's set in Athens, just like the Midsummer Night's Dream. "Set on the soul's Acropolis, the reason stands, a virgin armed, commercing with celestial light. And he who sins against her has defiled his own virginity. No cleansing makes his garment white. So clear is reason." So he's saying there, if you know something is a fact, whether it's a convenient fact or an inconvenient fact, if you've demonstrated a truth, you better not pretend it's not true because you'd rather it wasn't. No cleansing makes your garment white. If something is the case, it's the case. Okay? So clear is reason. But how dark imagining, warm, dark, obscure and infinite, daughter of night, dark is her brow. The beauty of her eyes with sleep is loaded, and her pains are long, and her delight. Tempt not Athene, wound not in her fertile pains Demeter, nor rebel against her mother right. Oh, who will reconcile in me both maid and mother? Who make a concord of the depth and height? Who make imagination's dim exploring touch ever report the same as intellectual sight? Then could I truly say and not deceive, then wholly say that I believe. Amazing poem, eh? Written just before his conversion. I mean, it's an amazing poem in lots of ways. Partly, you know, you get this cliched image of C.S. Lewis as this tweed-clad don who couldn't get on with women and was, you know, all this, you know, probably misogynist or, you know, et cetera. And then he's writing about his inner life. And what he's basically saying in this poem is, my problem is I can't get my inner goddesses together, you know. I mean, the two deepest powers of his soul, his reason and his imagination, are both figured and imagined as feminine. Anyway. And look, at he's saying, I've got this thing. I've got to be true to my reason, but I can't ignore my imagination. They've been split up. How will I get them together? And here's the question. Who will reconcile in me both maid and mother? He's looking for a reconciler. He's looking for a bridge between the height and the depth. We have this ministry of reconciliation. Who is the one who came into the world through someone who is both maid and mother? And then he goes on to say, who make in me a concord of the depth and height? You can almost hear, you know, those verses in Ephesians trembling on the lips of the angels as atheist Lewis writes this poem. You know, it says that you may have power to comprehend with all the saints what is the length and breadth and depth and height and know the love of God which surpasses knowledge. You know that the answer to this question, who, is Christ. That in Christ, both his imagination and his reason will be satisfied. Both of them will be nurtured. And of course, it was not long after this that he had that famous walk along Addison's Walk with Hugo Dyson and J.R.R. Tolkien about Christianity, in which he said, I can respond to it as, if it's just a fact, it makes me no difference to me. I could respond to it as a myth, but if it's just a myth, it's not true, so it doesn't work. And Tolkien says, can't you see that it's myth made fact? Can't you see that it's the greatest and most resonant imaginative story, also made objective and particular and available to you, earthed and bodied? And you can see the two hemispheres of Lewis's mind sort of trembling and coming together with Christ at the center, enabling both those ways of knowing to go on. So I think that that healing of that rift and divide is it was a finished work in Lewis, thanks be to God. But it's an unfinished work in our culture. We're still living in and with and through that split. And the denied and suppressed bit of that split is the imagination. So in order to reconcile them, in order not to divide what God has put together, we need first to revive and trust the imagination again. And then we need to see how that works together with the reason and how, in fact, Christ is the reconciler of both of those things. I think I run past my moments and we want a little bit of questions, so I'll stop there. I hope that was a helpful reflection.